camera. The pictures were taken after the drama at the bridge was over, but before anyone was aware that Harriet had disappeared. He studied their faces. This was the dinner she should have attended. Did any of the men know that she was gone? The photographs provided no answer. Then suddenly he choked on his coffee. He started coughing and sat up straight in his chair. At the far end of the table sat Cecilia Wanger in her light-coloured dress, smiling into the camera. Next to her sat another blonde woman with long hair and an identical light-coloured dress. They were so alike that they could have been twins. And suddenly the puzzle piece fell into place. Cecilia wasn't the one in Harriet's window. It was her sister, Anita, 2 years her junior, and now living in London. What was it Salander had said? Cecilia Wanger is in a lot of the pictures. Not at all. There were two girls, and as chance would have it, until now, they had never been seen in the same frame. In the black-and-white photographs from a distance, they looked identical. Wanger had presumably always been able to tell the sisters apart, but for Blomqvist and Salander, the girls looked so alike that they had assumed it was one person, and no one had ever pointed out their mistake because they had never thought to ask. Blomqvist turned the page and felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand on end. It was as if a cold gust of wind passed through the room. There were pictures taken the next day, when the search for Harriet had begun. A young Inspector Morel was giving instructions to a search party consisting of 2 uniformed police officers and 10 men wearing boots who were about to set out. Wanger was wearing a knee-length raincoat and a narrow-brimmed English hat. On the left of the photograph stood a young, slightly stout young man with light, longish hair. He had on a dark padded jacket with a red patch at the shoulder. The image was very clear. Blomqvist recognized him at once, and the jacket, but just to make sure he removed the photograph and went down to ask Anna if she recognized the man. "Yes, of course. That's Martin." Salander ploughed through year after year of press cuttings, moving in chronological order. She began in 1949 and worked her way forward. The archive was huge. The company was mentioned in the media nearly every day during the relevant time period, not only in the local press but also in the national media. There were financial analyses, trade union negotiations, the threat of strikes, factory openings and factory closings, annual reports, changes in managers, new products that were launched. There was a flood of news. Click, click, click. Her brain was working at high speed as she focused and absorbed the information from the yellowing pages. After several hours, she had an idea. She asked the archives manager if there was a chart showing where the Wanger Corporation had factories or companies during the 50s and 60s. Bodil Lindgren looked at Salander with undisguised coldness. She was not at all happy giving a total stranger permission to enter the inner sanctum of the firm's archives, being obliged to allow her to look through whatever documents she liked. And besides, this girl looked like some sort of half-witted 15-year-old anarchist. But Herr Fröder had given her instructions that could not be misinterpreted. This slip of a girl was to be free to look at anything she pleased. And it was urgent. She brought out the printed annual reports for the years that Salander wanted to see. Each report contained a chart of the firm's divisions throughout Sweden. Salander looked at the charts and saw that the firm had many factories, offices, and sales outlets. At every site where a murder was committed, there was also a red dot, sometimes several, indicating the Wanger Corporation. She found the first connection in 1957. Raquel Lunde, Landskrona, was found dead, the day after the V&C Construction Company clinched an order worth several million to build a galleria in the town. V&C stood for Wanger and Carlén Construction. The local paper had interviewed Gottfried Wanger, who had come to town to sign the contract. Salander recalled something she had read in the police investigation in the provincial record office in Landskrona. Raquel Lunde, fortune-teller in her free time, was an office cleaner. She had worked for V&C Construction. At 7 in the evening, Blomqvist called Salander a dozen times, and each time her mobile was turned off. She did not want to be disturbed. He wandered restlessly through the house. He had pulled out Wanger's notes on Martin's activities at the time of Harriet's disappearance. Martin Wanger was in his last year at the preparatory school in Uppsala in 1966. Uppsala. Lena Andersson. 17-year-old preparatory school pupil. Head separated from the fat. Wanger had mentioned this at one point, but Blomqvist had to consult his notes to find the passage. Martin had been an introverted boy. They had been worried about him. After his father drowned, Isabella had decided to send him to Uppsala. A change of scene where he was given room and board with Harold Wanger. Harold and Martin? It hardly felt right. Martin Wanger was not with Harold in the car going to the gathering in Hederstad, and he had missed a train. He arrived late in the afternoon, and so was among those stranded on the wrong side of the bridge. He only arrived on the island by boat sometime after 6. He was received by Wanger himself, among others. Wanger had put Martin far down the list of people who might have had anything to do with Harriet's disappearance. Martin said that he had not seen Harriet on that day. He was lying. He had arrived in Hederstad earlier in the day, and he was on Järnvägsgatan, face to face with his sister. Blomqvist could prove the lie with photographs that had been buried for almost 40 years. Harriet Wanger had seen her brother, and reacted with shock. She had gone out to Hedeby Island and tried to talk to Henrik, but she was gone before any conversation could take place. What were you thinking of telling him? Uppsala? But Lena Andersson, Uppsala, was not on the list. You could not have known about it. The story still did not make sense to Blomqvist. Harriet had disappeared around 3 in the afternoon. Martin was unquestionably on the other side of the water at that time. He could be seen in the photograph from the church hill. He could not possibly have hurt Harriet on the island. One puzzle piece was still missing. An accomplice? Anita Wanger? From the archives, Salander could see that Gottfried Wanger's position within the firm had changed over the years. At the age of 20 in 1947, he met Isabella, and immediately got her pregnant. Martin Wanger was born in 1948, and with that there was no question but that the young people would marry. When Gottfried was 22, he was brought into the main office of the Wanger Corporation by Henrik Wanger. He was obviously talented, and they may have been grooming him to take over. He was promoted to the board at the age of 25, as the assistant head of the company's development division, a rising star. Sometime in the mid-50s, his star began to plummet. He drank. His marriage to Isabella was on the rocks. The children, Harriet and Martin, were not doing well. Henrik drew the line. Gottfried's career had reached its zenith. In 1956, another appointment was made, another assistant head of development. 2 assistant heads. One who did the work, while Gottfried drank and was absent for long periods of time. But Gottfried was still a Wanger, as well as charming and eloquent. From 1957 on, his work seemed to consist of travelling around the country to open factories, resolve local conflicts, and spread an image that company management really did care. "We're sending out one of our own sons to listen to your problems. We do take you seriously." Salander found a second connection. Gottfried Wanger had participated in a negotiation in Karlstad, where the Wanger Corporation had bought a timber company. On the following day, a farmer's wife, Magda Lovisa Schoberg, was found murdered. Salander discovered the third connection just 15 minutes later. Uddevalla, 1962, the same day that Lea Persson disappeared, the local paper had interviewed Gottfried Wanger about a possible expansion of the harbour. When Fru Lindgren had wanted to close up and go home at 5:30, Salander had snapped at her that she was a long way from finished yet. She could go home as long as she left the key, and Salander would lock up. By that time, the archives manager was so infuriated that a girl like this one could boss her around that she called Herr Froda. Froda told her that Salander could stay all night if she wanted to. Would Fru Lindgren please notify security at the office so that they could let Salander out when she wanted to leave? 3 hours later, getting on for 8:30, Salander had concluded that Gottfried Wanger had been close to where at least 5 of the 8 murders were committed, either during the days before or after the event. She was still missing information about the murders in 1949 and 1954. She studied a newspaper photograph of him, a slim, handsome man with dark blonde hair. He looked rather like Clark Gable in Gone with the Wind. In 1949, Gottfried was 22 years old. The first murder took place in his home territory, Hedestad. Rebecca Jacobson, who worked at the Wanger Corporation. Where did the two of you meet? What did you promise her? Salander bit her lip. The problem was that Gottfried Wanger had drowned when he was drunk in 1965, while the last murder was committed in Uppsala in February 1966. She wondered if she was mistaken when she had added Lena Andersson, the 17-year-old schoolgirl, to the list. No. It might not be the same signature, but it was the same Bible parody. They must be connected. By 9 it was getting dark. The air was cool and it was drizzling. Mikael was sitting in the kitchen drumming his fingers on the table when Martin Wanger's Volvo crossed the bridge and turned out towards the point. That somehow brought matters to a head. He did not know what he should do. His whole being was burning with a desire to ask questions, to initiate a confrontation. It was certainly not a sensible attitude to have if he suspected Martin Wanger of being an insane murderer who had killed his sister and a girl in Uppsala, and who had also very nearly succeeded in killing him, too. But Martin was also a magnet, and he did not know that Blomqvist knew. He could go and see him with a pretext that... Well, he wanted to return the key to Gottfried Wanger's cabin. Blomqvist locked the door behind him and strolled out to the point. Harold Wanger's house was pitch dark, as usual. In Henrik's house, the lights were off except in one room facing the courtyard. Anna had gone to bed. Isabella's house was dark. Cecilia wasn't at home. The lights were on upstairs in Alexander's house, but they were off in the two houses occupied by people who were not members of the Wanger family. He did not see a soul. He paused irresolutely outside Martin Wanger's house, took out his mobile, and punched in Salander's number. Still no answer. He turned off his mobile so that it would not start ringing. There were lights on downstairs. Blomqvist walked across the lawn and stopped a few yards from the kitchen window, but he could see no one. He continued on around the house, pausing at each window, but there was no sign of Martin. On the other hand, he did discover that the small side door into the garage was slightly open.
"Don't be a damn fool."
But he could not resist the temptation to look. The first thing he saw on the carpenter's bench was an open box of ammunition for a Moose rifle. Then he saw two gasoline cans on the floor under the bench. "Preparations for another nocturnal visit, Martin?"
"Come in, Mikael. I saw you on the road."
Blomqvist's heart skipped a beat. Slowly he turned his head and saw Martin Wanger standing in the dark by a door leading into the house.
"You simply couldn't stay away, could you?"
His voice was calm, almost friendly.
"Hi, Martin," Blomqvist said.
"Come in," Martin repeated. "This way."
He took a step forward and to the side, holding out his left hand in an inviting gesture. He raised his right hand, and Blomqvist saw the reflection of dull metal.
"I have a Glock in my hand. Don't do anything stupid. At this distance I won't miss."
Blomqvist slowly moved closer. When he reached Martin, he stopped and looked him in the eye.
"I had to come here. There are so many questions."
"I understand. Through the door."
Blomqvist entered the house. The passage led to the hall near the kitchen, but before he got that far, Martin Wanger stopped him by putting a hand lightly on Blomqvist's shoulder.
"No, not that way. To your right. Open the door."
The basement. When Blomqvist was halfway down the steps, Martin Wanger turned a switch, and the lights went on. To the right of him was the boiler room. Ahead he could smell the scents of laundry. Martin guided him to the left into a storage room with old furniture and boxes, at the back of which was a steel security door with a deadbolt lock.
"Here,"
Martin said, tossing a key ring to Blomqvist.
"Open it."
He opened the door.
"The switch is on the left."
Blomqvist had opened the door to hell. Around 9, Salander went to get some coffee and a plastic-wrapped sandwich from the vending machine in the corridor outside the archives. She kept on, paging through old documents, looking for any trace of Gottfried Wanger in Kalmar in 1954. She found nothing. She thought about calling Blomqvist, but decided to go through the staff newsletters before she called it a day. The space was approximately 10 by 20 feet. Blomqvist assumed that it was situated along the north side of the house. Martin Wanger had contrived his private torture chamber with great care. On the left were chains, metal eyelets in the ceiling and floor, a table with leather straps where he could restrain his victims, and then the video equipment. A taping studio. In the back of the room was a steel cage for his guests. To the right of the door was a bench, a bed, and a TV corner with videos on a shelf. As soon as they entered the room, Martin Wanger aimed the pistol at Blomqvist and told him to lie on his stomach on the floor. Blomqvist refused.
"Very well," Martin said. "Then I'll shoot you in the kneecap."
He took aim. Blomqvist capitulated. He had no choice. He had hoped that Martin would relax his guard just a tenth of a second. He knew he would win any sort of fight with him. He had had half a chance in the passage upstairs when Martin put his hand on his shoulder, but he had hesitated. After that, Martin had not come close. With a bullet in his kneecap, he would have lost his chance. He lay down on the floor. Martin approached from behind and told him to put his hands on his back. He handcuffed him. Then he kicked Mikhail in the crotch and punched him viciously and repeatedly. What happened after that seemed like a nightmare. Martin swung between rationality and pure lunacy. For a time quite calm, the next instant he would be pacing back and forth like an animal in a cage. He kicked Blomqvist several times. All Blomqvist could do was try to protect his head and take the blows in the soft parts of his body. For the first half hour, Martin did not say a word, and he appeared to be incapable of any sort of communication. After that, he seemed to recover control. He put a chain round Blomqvist's neck, fastening it with a padlock to a metal eyelet on the floor. He left Blomqvist alone for about 15 minutes. When he returned, he was carrying a liter bottle of water. He sat on a chair and looked at Blomqvist as he drank.
"Could I have some water?" Blomqvist said.
Martin leaned down and let him take a good long drink from the bottle. Blomqvist swallowed greedily.
"Thanks." "Still so polite, Caleb Blomqvist." "Why all the punching and kicking?" Blomqvist said.
"Because you make me very angry indeed. You deserve to be punished. Why didn't you just go home? You were needed at Millennium." "I was serious. We could have made it into a great magazine. We could have worked together for years."
Blomqvist grimaced and tried to shift his body into a more comfortable position. He was defenseless. All he had was his voice.
"I assume you mean that the opportunity has passed," Blomqvist said.
Martin Wanger laughed.
"I'm sorry, Mikhail, but of course you know perfectly well that you're going to die down here."
Blomqvist nodded.
"How the hell did you find me? You and that anorexic spook that you dragged into this."
"You lied about what you were doing on the day that Harriet disappeared. You were in Hedestad at the Children's Day parade. You were photographed there, looking at Harriet."
"Was that why you went to North Shore?"
"To get the picture, yes.
It was taken by a honeymoon couple who happened to be in Hedestad."
He shook his head.
"That's a crass lie," Martin said.
Blomqvist thought hard. What to say to prevent or postpone his execution?
"Where's the picture now?"
"The negative? It's in a safe deposit box at Handelsbanken here in Hedestad."
"You didn't know that I have a safe deposit box?"
He lied easily.
"There are copies in various places, in my computer and in the girls, on the server at Millennium, and on the server at Milton Security where the girl works."
Martin waited, trying to work out whether or not Blomqvist was bluffing.
"How much does the girl know?"
Blomqvist hesitated. Salander was, right now, his only hope of rescue. What would she think? when she came home and found him not there. He had put the photograph of Martin Wanger wearing the padded jacket on the kitchen table. Would she make the connection? Would she sound the alarm? She's not going to call the police. The nightmare was that she would come to Martin Wanger's house and ring the bell, demanding to know where Blomqvist was.
"Answer me,"
Martin said, his voice ice cold.
"I'm thinking."
"She knows almost as much as I do, maybe even a little more."
"Yes, I would reckon she knows more than I do. She's bright. She's the one who made the link to Lena Anderson."
"Lena Anderson?"
Martin sounded perplexed.
"The girl you tortured and killed in Uppsala in 1966. Don't tell me you've forgotten."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
But for the first time he sounded shaken. It was the first time that anyone had made that connection. Lena Anderson was not included in Harriet's date book.
"Martin," Blomqvist said, making his voice as steady as he could, "it's over. You can kill me, but it's finished. Too many people know."
Martin started pacing back and forth again.
"I have to remember that he's irrational. The cat. He could have brought the cat down here, but he went to the family crypt."
Martin stopped.
"I think you're lying. You and Salander are the only ones who know anything. You obviously haven't talked to anyone, or the police would have been here by now. A nice little blaze in the guest cottage, and the proof will be gone. And if you're wrong..."
"If I'm wrong, then it really is over.
But I don't think it is."
"I'll bet that you're bluffing.
And what other choice do I have?"
"I'll give that some thought. It's that anorexic little cunt who's the weak link."
"She went to Stockholm at lunchtime." Martin laughed.
"Bluff away, Mikael. She has been sitting in the archives at the Wanger Corporation offices all evening."
Blomqvist's heart skipped a beat.
"He knew. He's known all along."
"That's right. The plan was to visit the archive and then go to Stockholm," Blomqvist said.
"I didn't know she stayed there so long."
"Stop all this crap, Mikael."
"The archives manager rang to tell me that Dirk had let the girl stay there as late as she liked, which means she'll certainly be home. The night watchman is going to call me when she leaves."
Part 4. Hostile Takeover. July 11th to December 30th. 92% of women in Sweden who have been subjected to sexual assault have not reported the most recent violent incident to the police. Chapter 24. Friday, July 11th to Saturday, July 12th. Martin Wanger bent down and went through Mikael's pockets. He took the key.
"Smart of you to change the lock,"
he said.
"I'm going to take care of your girlfriend when she gets back."
Blomqvist reminded himself that Martin was a negotiator experienced from many industrial battles. He had already seen through one bluff.
"Why?"
"Why what?"
"Why all of this?"
Blomqvist gestured vaguely at the space around him. Martin bent down and put one hand under Blomqvist's chin, lifting his head so their eyes met.
"Because it's so easy," he said. "Women disappear all the time. Nobody misses them. Immigrants. Whores from Russia. Thousands of people pass through Sweden every year."
He let go of Blomqvist's head and stood up. Martin's words hit Blomqvist like a punch in the face.
"Christ almighty. This is no historical mystery. Martin Wanger is murdering women today. And I wandered right into it. As it happens, I don't have a guest right now. But it might amuse you to know that while you and Henrik sat around babbling this winter and spring, there was a girl down here, Irina from Belarus. While you sat and ate dinner with me, she was locked up in the cage down here. It was a pleasant evening, as I remember, no?"
Martin perched on the table, letting his legs dangle. Blomqvist shut his eyes. He suddenly felt acid in his throat, and he swallowed hard. The pain in his gut and in his ribs seemed to swell.
"What do you do with the bodies?"
"I have my boat at the dock right below here. I take them a long way out to sea.
Unlike my father, I don't leave traces. But he was smart, too. He spread his victims out all over Sweden.
The puzzle pieces were falling into place.
Gottfried Wanger, from 1949 until 1965. Then Martin Wanger, starting in 1966 in Uppsala.
You admire your father?
He was the one who taught me. He initiated me when I was 14.
Udvala, Lea Persson.
Aren't you clever? Yes, I was there. I only watched, but I was there.
1964. Seravit, in Ronneby.
I was 16. It was the first time I had a woman. My father taught me. I was the one who strangled her.
He's bragging. Good Lord, what a revoltingly sick family.
You can't have any notion of how demented this is.
You are a very ordinary little person, Mikhail. You would not be able to understand the godlike feeling of having absolute control over someone's life and death.
You enjoy torturing and killing women, Martin.
I don't think so, really. If I do an intellectual analysis of my condition, I'm more of a serial rapist than a serial murderer. In fact, most of all, I'm a serial kidnapper. The killing is a natural consequence, so to speak, because I have to hide my crime. Of course, my actions aren't socially acceptable, but my crime is first and foremost a crime against the conventions of society. Death doesn't come until the end of my guests' visits here, after I've grown weary of them. It's always so fascinating to see their disappointment.
Disappointment?
Exactly. Disappointment. They imagine that if they please me, they'll live. They adapt to my rules. They start to trust me and develop a certain camaraderie with me, hoping to the very end that this camaraderie means something. The disappointment comes when it finally dawns on them that they've been well and truly screwed.
Martin walked around the table and leaned against the steel cage.
You, with your bourgeois conventions, would never grasp this, but the excitement comes from planning a kidnapping. They are not done on impulse. Those kinds of kidnappers invariably get caught. It's a science with thousands of details that I have to weigh. I have to identify my prey, map out her life. Who is she? Where does she come from? How can I make contact with her? What do I have to do to be alone with my prey without revealing my name or having it turn up in any future police investigation?
Shut up, for God's sake, Blomqvist thought.
Are you really interested in all this, Mikhail?
He bent down and stroked Blomqvist's cheek. The touch was almost tender.
You realize that this can only end one way. Will it bother you if I smoke?
You could offer me a cigarette, he said.
Martin lit two cigarettes and carefully placed one of them between Blomqvist's lips, letting him take a long drag.
Thanks, Blomqvist said automatically.
Martin Wanger laughed again.
You see? You've already started to adapt to the submission principle. I hold your life in my hands, Mikhail. You know that I can dispatch you at any second. You pleaded with me to improve your quality of life, and you did so by using reason and a little good manners. And you were rewarded.
Blomqvist nodded. His heart was pounding so hard it was almost unbearable. At 11:15, Lisbeth Salander drank the rest of the water from her PET bottle as she turned the pages. Unlike Blomqvist, who earlier in the day had choked on his coffee, she didn't get the water down the wrong way. On the other hand, she did open her eyes wide when she made the connection. Click. For 2 hours, she had been wading through the staff newsletters from all points of the compass. The main newsletter was Company Information. It bore the Wanger logo, a Swedish banner fluttering in the wind with a point forming an arrow. The publication was presumably put together by the firm's advertising department, and it was filled with propaganda that was supposed to make the employees feel that they were members of one big family. In association with the winter sports holiday in February 1967, Henrik Wanger in a magnanimous gesture, had invited 50 employees from the main office and their families to a week's skiing holiday in Härjedalen. The company had made record profits during the previous year. The PR department went to and put together a picture report. Many of the pictures with amusing captions were from the slopes. Some showed groups in the bar with laughing employees hoisting beer mugs. Two photographs were of a small morning function when Henrik Wanger proclaimed Ulla Britt Mogren to be the best office worker of the year. She was given a bonus of 500 kronor and a glass bowl. The ceremony was held on the terrace of the hotel, clearly right before people were thinking of heading back to the slopes. About 20 people were in the picture. On the far right, just behind Henrik Wanger, stood a man with long blonde hair. He was wearing a dark padded jacket with a distinctive patch at the shoulder. Since the publication was in black and white, the colour wasn't identifiable, but Salander was willing to bet her life that the shoulder patch was red. The caption explained the connection. Far right, Martin Wanger, 19, who is studying in Uppsala. He is already being discussed as someone with a promising future in the company's management.
Gotcha, Salander said in a low voice.
She switched off the desk lamp and left the newsletters in piles all over the desk.
Something for that slut Lindgren to take care of tomorrow.
She went out to the car park, through a side door. As it closed behind her, she remembered that she had promised to tell the night watchman when she left. She stopped and let her eyes sweep over the car park. The watchman's office was on the other side of the building. That meant that she would have to walk all the way round to the other side.
Let sleeping dogs lie, she decided.
Before she put on her helmet, she turned on her mobile and called Blomqvist's number. She got a message saying that the subscriber could not be reached, but she also saw that he had tried to call her no fewer than 13 times between 3:30 and 9. In the last 2 hours, no call. Salander tried the cottage number, but there was no answer. She frowned, strapped on her computer, put on her helmet and kick-started the motorcycle. The ride from the main office at the entrance to Herestad's industrial district out to Hedeby Island took 10 minutes. A light was on in the kitchen. Salander looked around. Her first thought was that Blomqvist had gone to see Froda, but from the bridge she had already noticed that the lights were off in Froda's house on the other side of the water. She looked at her watch. 11:40. She went into the cottage, opened the wardrobe and took out the two PCs that she was using to store the surveillance pictures from the cameras she had installed. It took her a while to run up the sequence of events. At 15:32, Blomqvist entered the cabin. At 16:03, he took his coffee cup out to the garden. He had a folder with him which he studied. He made 3 brief telephone calls during the hour he spent out in the garden. The 3 calls corresponded exactly to calls she had not answered. At 17:21, Blomqvist left the cottage. He was back less than 15 minutes later. At 18:20, he went to the gate and looked in the direction of the bridge. At 21:03, he went out. He had not come back. Salander fast-forwarded through the pictures from the other PC, which photographed the gate and the road outside the front door. She could see who had gone past during the day. At 19:12, Nielsen came home. At 19:42, the Saab that belonged to Ustergården drove towards Hedestad. At 20:02, the Saab was on its way back. At 21:00, Martin Wanger's car went by. 3 minutes later, Blomqvist left the house. At 21:50, Martin Wanger appeared in the camera's viewfinder. He stood at the gate for over a minute, looking at the house, then peering through the kitchen window. He went up to the porch and tried the door, taking out a key. He must have discovered that they had put in a new lock. He stood still for a moment before he turned on his heel and left the house. Salander felt an ice-cold fear in her gut. Martin Wanger once again left Blomqvist alone. He was still in his uncomfortable position with his hands behind his back and his neck fastened by a thin chain to an eyelet in the floor. He fiddled with the handcuffs, but he knew that he would not be able to get them off. The cuffs were so tight that his hands were numb. He had no chance. He shut his eyes. He did not know how much time had passed when he heard Martin's footsteps again. He appeared in Blomqvist's field of vision. He looked worried.
"Uncomfortable?" he said.
"Very," said Blomqvist.
"You've only got yourself to blame. You should have gone back to Stockholm."
Why do you kill Martin?
It's a choice that I made. I could discuss the moral and intellectual aspects of what I do. We could talk all night, but it wouldn't change anything. Try to look at it this way. A human being is a shell made of skin, keeping the cells, blood, and chemical components in place. Very few end up in the history books. Most people succumb and disappear without a trace.
You kill women.
Those of us who murder for pleasure. I'm not the only one with this hobby. We live a complete life.
But why, Harriet? Your own sister.
In a second, Martin grabbed him by the hair.
What happened to her, you little bastard? Tell me! What do you mean?
Blomqvist gasped. He tried to turn his head to lessen the pain in his scalp. The chain tightened round his neck.
You and Salander! What have you come up with? Let go, for heaven's sake! We're talking!
Martin Wanger let go of his hair and sat cross-legged in front of Blomqvist. He took a knife from his jacket and opened it. He set the point against the skin just below Blomqvist's eye. Blomqvist forced himself to meet Martin's gaze.
What the hell happened to her, bastard?
I don't understand. I thought you killed her.
Martin Wanger stared at Blomqvist for a long moment, then he relaxed. He got up and wandered around the room, thinking. He threw the knife on the floor and laughed before he came back to face Blomqvist.
Harriet! Harriet! Always Harriet! We tried to talk to her. Gottfried tried to teach her. We thought that she was one of us, and that she would accept her duty. But she was just an ordinary cunt. I had her under control, or so I thought. But she was planning to tell Henrik, and I realized that I couldn't trust her. Sooner or later she was going to tell someone about me.
You killed her.
I wanted to kill her. I thought about it, but I arrived too late. I couldn't get over to the island.
Blomqvist's brain was with difficulty trying to absorb this information, but it felt as if a message had popped up with the words information overload. Martin Wanger did not know what had happened to his sister. All of a sudden Martin pulled his mobile telephone out of his pocket, glanced at the display, and put it on the chair next to the pistol.
It's time to stop all this. I have to dispose of your anorexic bitch tonight, too.
He took out a narrow leather strap from a cupboard and slipped it round Blomqvist's neck like a noose. He loosened the chain that held him shackled to the floor, hauled him to his feet, and shoved him towards the wall. He slipped the leather strap through a loop above Blomqvist's head and then tightened it so that he was forced to stand on tiptoes.
Is that too tight? Can you breathe?
He loosened it a notch and locked the other end of the strap in place further down the wall.
I don't want you to suffocate all at once.
The noose was cutting so hard into Blomqvist's throat that he was incapable of uttering a word. Martin looked at him attentively. Abruptly, he unzipped Blomqvist's trousers and tugged them down, along with his boxer shorts. As he pulled them off, Blomqvist lost his foothold and dangled for a second from the noose before his toes again made contact with the floor. Martin went over to a cupboard and took out a pair of scissors. He cut off Blomqvist's T-shirt and tossed the bits on the floor. Then he took up a position some distance away from Mikhail and regarded his victim.
"I've never had a boy in here," Martin said in a serious voice. "I've never touched another man, as a matter of fact. Except for my father. That was my duty."
Blomqvist's temples were pounding. He could not put his weight on his feet without being strangled. He tried to use his fingers to get a grip on the concrete wall behind him, but there was nothing to hold on to.
"It's time,"
Martin Wanger said. He put his hand on the strap and pulled down. Blomqvist instantly felt the noose cutting into his neck.
"I've always wondered how a man tastes."
He increased the pressure on the noose and leaned forward to kiss Blomqvist on the lips, at the same time that a cold voice cut through the room.
"Hey, you fucking creep! In this shithole I've got a monopoly on that one!"
Blomqvist heard Salander's voice through a red fog. He managed to focus his eyes enough to see her standing in the doorway. She was looking at Martin Wanger without expression.
No! Run!
He croaked. He could not see the look on Martin's face, but he could almost physically feel the shock when he turned around. For a second, time stood still. Then Martin reached for the pistol he had left on the chair. Salander took three swift strides forward and swung a golf club she had hidden at her side. The iron flew in a wide arc and hit Martin on the collarbone near his shoulder. The blow had a terrible force, and Blomqvist heard something snap. Martin howled.
"Do you like pain, creep?"
Salander said. Her voice was as rough as sandpaper. As long as Blomqvist lived, he would never forget her face as she went on the attack. Her teeth were bared like a beast of prey. Her eyes were glittering, black as coal. She moved with the lightning speed of a tarantula, and seemed totally focused on her prey as she swung the club again, striking Martin in the ribs. He stumbled over the chair and fell. The pistol tumbled to the floor at Salander's feet. She kicked it away. Then she struck for the third time, just as Martin Wanger was trying to get to his feet. She hit him with a loud smack on the hip. A horrible cry issued from Martin's throat. The fourth blow struck him from behind, between the shoulder blades. Blomqvist gasped. He was about to pass out, and the pain in his temples was almost unbearable. She turned to him and saw that his face was the colour of a tomato. His eyes were open wide, and his tongue was popping out of his mouth. She looked about her and saw the knife on the floor. Then she spared a glance at Martin Wanger, who was trying to crawl away from her, one arm hanging. He would not be making any trouble for the next few seconds. She let go of the golf club and picked up the knife. It had a sharp point, but a dull edge. She stood on her toes and frantically sawed at the leather strap to get it off. It took several seconds before Blomqvist sank to the floor, but the noose was pulled tighter round his neck. Salander looked again at Martin Wanger. He was on his feet, but doubled over. She tried to dig her fingers under the noose. At first, she did not dare cut it, but finally she slipped the point of the knife underneath, scoring Blomqvist's neck as she tried to expand the noose. At last, it loosened, and Blomqvist took several shaky, wheezing breaths. For a moment, Blomqvist had a sensation of his body and soul uniting. He had perfect vision and could make out every speck of dust in the room. He had perfect hearing and registered every breath, every rustle of clothing, as if they were entering his ears through a headset. And he was aware of the odour of Salander's sweat and the smell of leather from her jacket. Then the illusion burst, as blood began streaming to his head. Salander turned her head just as Martin Wanger disappeared out the door. She got up, grabbed the pistol, checked the magazine, and flicked off the safety. She looked around and focused on the keys to the handcuffs, which lay in plain sight on the table.
"I'm going to take him," she said, running for the door.
She grabbed the keys as she passed the table and tossed them backhanded to the floor next to Blomqvist. He tried to shout to her to wait, but he managed only a rasping sound, and by then she had vanished. Salander had not forgotten that Martin Wanger had a rifle somewhere, and she stopped, holding the pistol ready to fire in front of her as she came upstairs to the passageway between the garage and the kitchen. She listened, but she could hear no sound telling her where her prey was. She moved stealthily towards the kitchen, and she was almost there when she heard a car starting up in the courtyard. From the drive she saw a pair of tail lights passing Henrik Wanger's house and turning down to the bridge, and she ran as fast as her legs could carry her. She stuffed the pistol in her jacket pocket and did not bother with the helmet as she started her motorcycle. Seconds later, she was crossing the bridge. He had maybe a 90-second start when she came into the roundabout at the entrance to the E4. She could not see his car. She braked and turned off the motor to listen. The sky was filled with heavy clouds. On the horizon she saw a hint of the dawn. Then she heard the sound of an engine and caught a glimpse of taillights on the E4 going south. Salander kicked the motorcycle, put it into gear, and raced under the viaduct. She was doing 40 miles per hour as she took the curve of the entrance ramp. She saw no traffic and accelerated to full speed and flew forward. When the road began to curve along a ridge, she was doing 90 miles per hour, which was about the fastest her souped-up, lightweight bike could manage going downhill. After 2 minutes, she saw the lights about 650 yards ahead. "Analyze consequences. What do I do now?" She decelerated to a more reasonable 75 and kept pace with him. She lost sight of him for several seconds when they took several bends. Then they came onto a long straight. She was only 200 yards behind him. He must have seen the headlight from her motorcycle, and he sped up when they took a long curve. She accelerated again but lost ground on the bends. She saw the headlights of a truck approaching. Martin Wanger did, too. He increased his speed again and drove straight into the oncoming lane. Salander saw the truck swerve and flash its lights, but the collision was unavoidable. Martin Wanger drove straight into the truck, and the sound of the crash was terrible. Salander braked. She saw the trailer start to jackknife across her lane. At the speed she was doing, it took 2 seconds for her to cover the distance up to the accident site. She accelerated and steered onto the hard shoulder, avoiding the hurtling back of the truck by 2 yards as she flew past. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw flames coming from the front of the truck. She rode on, braking and thinking for another 150 yards before she stopped and turned around. She saw the driver of the truck climb out of his cab on the passenger side. Then she accelerated again. At Ockerby, about a mile south, she turned left and took the old road back north, parallel to the E4. She went up a hill past the scene of the crash. 2 cars had stopped. Big flames were boiling out of the wreckage of Martin's car, which was wedged underneath the truck. A man was spraying the flames with a small fire extinguisher. She was soon rolling across the bridge at a low speed. She parked outside the cottage and walked back to Martin Wanger's house. Mikhail was still fumbling with the handcuffs. His hands were so numb that he could not get a grip on the key. Salander unlocked the cuffs for him and held him tight as the blood began to circulate in his hands again.
"Martin,"
he said in a hoarse voice.
"Dead. He drove slap into the front of a truck a couple of miles south on the E4.
Blomqvist stared at her. She had only been gone a few minutes.
"We have to call the police,"
he whispered. He began coughing hard.
"Why?"
Salander said. For 10 minutes, Blomqvist was incapable of standing up. He was still on the floor, naked, leaning against the wall. He massaged his neck and lifted the water bottle with clumsy fingers. Salander waited patiently until his sense of touch started to return. She spent the time thinking.
"Put your trousers on."
She used Blomqvist's cut-up T-shirt to wipe fingerprints from the handcuffs, the knife, and the golf club. She picked up her PET bottle.
"What are you doing?"
"Get dressed and hurry up. It's getting light outside."
Blomqvist stood on shaky legs and managed to pull on his boxers and jeans. He slipped on his trainers. Salander stuffed his socks into her jacket pocket and then stopped him.
"What exactly did you touch down here?"
Blomqvist looked around. He tried to remember. At last he said that he had touched nothing except the door and the keys. Salander found the keys in Martin Wanger's jacket, which he had hung over the chair. She wiped the door handle and the switch and turned off the light. She helped Blomqvist up the basement stairs and told him to wait in the passageway while she put the golf club back in its proper place. When she came back, she was carrying a dark T-shirt that belonged to Martin Wanger.
"Put this on. I don't want anyone to see you scampering about with a bare chest tonight."
Blomqvist realized that he was in a state of shock. Salander had taken charge, and passively he obeyed her instructions. She led him out of Martin's house. She held on to him the whole time. As soon as they stepped inside the cottage, she stopped him.
"If anyone sees us and asks what we were doing outside tonight, you and I went out to the point for a nighttime walk, and we had sex out there."
"Lisbeth, I can't..."
"Get in the shower, now!"
She helped him off with his clothes and propelled him to the bathroom. Then she put on water for coffee and made half a dozen thick sandwiches on rye bread with cheese and liver sausage and dill pickles. She sat down at the kitchen table and was thinking hard when he came limping back into the room. She studied the bruises and scrapes on his body. The noose had been so tight that he had a dark red mark around his neck, and the knife had made a bloody gash in his skin on the left side.
"Get into bed,"
she said. She improvised bandages and covered the wound with a makeshift compress. Then she poured the coffee and handed him a sandwich.
"I'm really not hungry,"
he said.
"I don't give a damn if you're hungry. Just eat,"
Salander commanded, taking a big bite of her own cheese sandwich. Blomqvist closed his eyes for a moment. Then he sat up and took a bite. His throat hurt so much that he could scarcely swallow. Salander took off her leather jacket and from the bathroom brought a jar of tiger balm from her sponge bag.
Let the coffee cool for a while. Lie face down.
She spent 5 minutes massaging his back and rubbing him with the liniment. Then she turned him over and gave him the same treatment on the front.
You're going to have some serious bruises for a while.
Lisbeth, we have to call the police.
No,
she replied, with such vehemence that Blomqvist opened his eyes in surprise.
If you call the police, I'm leaving. I don't want to have anything to do with them. Martin Wanger is dead. He died in a car accident. He was alone in the car. There are witnesses. Let the police or someone else discover that fucking torture chamber. You and I are just as ignorant about its existence as everyone else in this village.
Why?
She ignored him and started massaging his aching thighs.
Lisbeth, we can't just...
If you go on nagging, I'll drag you back to Martin's grotto and chain you up again.
As she said this, Blomqvist fell asleep, as suddenly as if he had fainted. Chapter 25. Saturday, July 12th, to Monday, July 14th. Blomqvist woke with a start at 5 a.m, scrabbling at his neck to get rid of the noose. Salander came in and took hold of his hands, keeping him still. He opened his eyes and looked at her blearily.
"I didn't know that you played golf,"
he said, closing his eyes again. She sat with him for a couple of minutes until she was sure he was asleep. While he slept, Salander had gone back to Martin Wanger's basement to examine and photograph the crime scene. In addition to the torture instruments, she had found a collection of violent pornographic magazines and a large number of Polaroid photographs pasted into albums. There was no diary. On the other hand, she did find 2 A4 binders with passport photographs and handwritten notes about the women. She put the binders in a nylon bag along with Martin's Dell PC laptop, which she found on the hall table upstairs. While Blomqvist slept, she continued her examination of Martin's computer and binders. It was after 6 by the time she turned off the computer. She lit a cigarette. Together with Mikhail Blomqvist, she had taken up the hunt for what they thought was a serial killer from the past. They had found something appallingly different. She could hardly imagine the horrors that must have played out in Martin Wanger's basement, in the midst of this well-ordered, idyllic spot. She tried to understand. Martin Wanger had been killing women since the 60s. During the past 15 years, 1 or 2 victims per year. The killing had been done so discreetly, and was so well planned, that no one was even aware that a serial killer was at work. How was that possible? The binders provided a partial answer. His victims were often new arrivals, immigrant girls who had no friends or social contacts in Sweden. There were also prostitutes and social outcasts with drug abuse or other problems in their background. From her own studies of the psychology of sexual sadism, Salander had learned that this type of murderer usually collected souvenirs from his victims. These souvenirs functioned as reminders that the killer could use to recreate some of the pleasure he had experienced. Martin Wanger had developed this peculiarity by keeping a death book. He had catalogued and graded his victims. He had described their suffering. He had documented his killings with videotapes and photographs. The violence and the killing were the goal, but Salander concluded that it was the hunt that was Martin Wanger's primary interest. In his laptop he had created a database with a list of more than 100 women. There were employees from the Wanger Corporation, waitresses in restaurants where he regularly ate, reception staff in hotels, clerks at the Social Security office, the secretaries of business associates, and many other women. It seemed as if Martin had pigeonholed practically every woman he had ever come into contact with. He had killed only a fraction of these women, but every woman anywhere near him was a potential victim. The cataloguing had the mark of a passionate hobby, and he must have devoted countless hours to it. Is she married or single? Does she have children and family? Where does she work? Where does she live? What kind of car does she drive? What sort of education does she have? Hair colour? Skin colour? Figure? The gathering of personal information about potential victims must have been a significant part of Martin Wanger's sexual fantasies. He was, first of all, a stalker, and second, a murderer. When she had finished reading, she discovered a small envelope in one of the binders. She pulled out two much-handled and faded Polaroid pictures. In the first picture, a dark-haired girl was sitting at a table. The girl had on dark jeans and had a bare torso with tiny, pointed breasts. She had turned her face away from the camera and was in the process of lifting one arm in a gesture of defense, almost as if the photographer had surprised her. In the second picture, she was completely naked. She was lying on her stomach on a blue bedspread. Her face was still turned away from the camera. Salander stuffed the envelope with the pictures into her jacket pocket. After that, she carried the binders over to the wood stove and struck a match. When she was done with the fire, she stirred the ashes. It was pouring down with rain when she took a short walk and, kneeling as if to tie a shoelace, discreetly dropped Martin Wanger's laptop into the water under the bridge. When Froda marched through the open door at 7:30 that morning, Salander was at the kitchen table smoking a cigarette and drinking coffee. Froda's face was ashen, and he looked as if he had had a cruel awakening.
"Where's Mikhail?" he said.
"He's still asleep."
Froda sat down heavily on a kitchen chair. Salander poured coffee and pushed the cup over to him.
"Martin, I just found out that Martin was killed in a car accident last night."
"That's sad," Salander said,
taking a sip of her own coffee. Froda looked up. At first he stared at her, uncomprehending. Then his eyes opened wide.
"What?"
"He crashed. How annoying."
"What do you know about this?"
"He drove his car right into the front of a truck. He committed suicide. The press, the stress, a floundering financial empire, ... too much for him. At least that's what I suppose it will say on the placards."
Froda looked as if he were about to have a cerebral hemorrhage. He stood up swiftly and walked unsteadily to the bedroom.
"Let him sleep," Salander snapped.
Froda looked at the sleeping figure. He saw the black and blue marks on Blomqvist's face and the contusions on his chest. Then he saw the flaming line where the noose had been. Salander touched his arm and closed the door. Froda backed out and sank onto the kitchen bench. Lisbeth Salander told him succinctly what had happened during the night. She told him what Martin Wanger's Chamber of Horrors looked like and how she had found Mikhail with a noose around his neck, and the CEO of the Wanger Corporation standing in front of his naked body. She told him what she had found in the company's archives the day before, and how she had established a possible link between Martin's father and the murders of at least 7 women. Froda interrupted her recitation only once. When she stopped talking, he sat mutely for several minutes before he took a deep breath and said,
"What are we going to do?"
"That's not for me to say," Salander said.
"But
as I see it, I've never set foot in Hedderstad."
"I don't understand."
"Under no circumstances do I want my name in any police report. I don't exist in connection with any of this. If my name is mentioned in connection with this story, I'll deny that I've ever been here, and I'll refuse to answer a single question."
Froda gave her a searching look.
"I don't understand."
"You don't need to understand."
"Then what should I do?"
"You'll have to work that out for yourself. Only leave me and Mikhail out of it."
Froda was deathly pale.
"Look at it this way. The only thing you know is that Martin Wanger died in a traffic accident. You have no idea that he was also an insane, nauseating serial killer, and you've never heard about the room in his basement."
She put the key on the table between them.
"You've got time, before anyone is going to clean out Martin's house and discover the basement."
"We have to go to the police about this."
"Not we. You can go to the police if you like. It's your decision."
"This can't be brushed under a carpet."
"I'm not suggesting that it should be brushed anywhere, just that you leave me and Mikhail out of it. When you discover the room, you draw your own conclusions, and decide for yourself who you want to tell."
"If what you say is true, it means that Martin has kidnapped and murdered women. There must be families that are desperate because they don't know where their children are. We can't just..."
"That's right. But there's just one problem. The bodies are gone. Maybe you'll find passports or ID cards in some drawer. Maybe some of the victims can be identified from the videotapes. But you don't need to decide